Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Okay, good morning. It's Monday, the 3rd of May, 2010. That makes this Solder Smoke 124. Good morning. Guys, I guess the first thing we need to talk about is, and this is kind of difficult, kind of painful, but we really do have to talk about Oprah. You know, there's so many ways I could start this. I thought about telling you that it had gone so well with Oprah that that next week I'm going to be on with Martha Stewart, because she's asked me to come in and explain to her my techniques for winding toroidal coils. She's especially interested in the tri-filler versions. And then perhaps I was going to say, you know, and then also, you know, this is the start of something really big, because Dr. Phil has asked me to come in to talk about the impact of home brewing on relationships. But no, I'm not going to do that to you, because I think most of you realize at this by this point that I did not appear on the Oprah television program. but I have to say, you know, when we thought about this year's April Fool's event, and that's what this was, for those of you who are still in the dark, we always try to find a way to quantify the success of the hoax, and this year we did it with the schedule website. You know, there's a special website that I posted that was ostensibly the program schedule for your particular viewing area to find out when Solder Smoke would appear on the Oprah Winfrey television program. And I have the stats on that, guys. Just last check, the last time I checked, some 532 radio amateurs wanted to find out when they could tune in to the Oprah show. So anyway, a lot of fun. I got all kinds of emails, and I thank everybody who very candidly admitted that they were victims, and several guys admitted to asking their wives to keep an eye on Oprah for the Solder Smoke guy. I could just picture, you know, the wives sitting there on the couch looking up at the radio amateur who just stepped in from the shack, thinking, are you nuts? What are you kidding? Oprah? Solder Smoke? What are you thinking? Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen, guys. No way. All right. So anyway, a fine amateur radio tradition. We're upholding it here at Solder Smoke for yet another year. And anyway, great fun. A little bit of Italian travelogue before we get to the technical stuff. We had a really interesting event right here in central Rome. They're making some sort of bid for the Olympics in 2020. And in one of Rome's most important plazas, Piazza del Popolo, which is right pretty much in the heart of Rome, one of the most beautiful piazzas in Rome, they had a sports day, and they invited kids from all over Rome to come in and display their sporting skills. They were particularly interested in kids who have participating in kind of more exotic sports activity. You know, if they did soccer, calcio, football, every kid in Rome would be there. But Billy was asked to go because he's in the last year or so, I think I've mentioned a few times that he's been involved in fencing, in Italian, what the Italians call scherma. And so his group of from the fencing school went off to Piazza del Popolo and were giving exhibitions of fencing right out there on the piazza. Amazing, great fun, and we've got some really spectacular pictures. I'll put one up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog page when I put up the announcement of this podcast. So that was great. Fencing on Piazza del Popolo, really good stuff. As far as Maria is concerned, I was asked to return to her fourth grade classroom, this time to speak about communication with satellites, especially the Mir space station. And her class was going through a unit on space exploration, and I just kind of mentioned to the teacher that I have this strange hobby that from time to time allows me to communicate with spacemen. You gotta be careful how you say that. Anyway, she believed me and asked me to come in. I pointed out that on my website I have the audio clips from kind of the audio highlights of those conversations with astronaut Norm Thagard on Mir Station back in, I guess it was 96-97 time frame. And she asked me to come in and play the clips for the kids and talk about ham radio and the space program. And I talk quite a bit about Norm Thagard because I think he's such an inspirational guy, especially for young people. I mentioned him in Solder Smoke, the book. Norm is definitely one of us. He built a Foxhole radio as a kid and was a radio amateur, got his ham radio license, really up from small town America, worked his way up, became a medical doctor, Marine Corps fighter pilot, electrical engineer, and capped it all off with a tour as several flights as a NASA astronaut, first American to fly on a Russian rocket. Pretty impressive. So the kids were, I think, really pleased to hear about Norm, and I had a lot of fun speaking over at the school. That was great fun. Hey, one thing in terms of travelogue, one thing that one of our listeners or blog readers pointed out, and I failed to mention this when we were all up in London and we went to visit Marconi's house. Did you guys catch the number on the door of Marconi's house? I didn't notice it when I was there. I was really focused on the blue plaque, and I was kind of worried about getting arrested for taking so many pictures in this one house. But in the whole process, I didn't notice it. And when we put the pictures up on the blog, somebody out there immediately shot me an email and said, "Check out the house number, 73. Coincidence? I don't think so. All right, thanks for that. So Marconi lived in house number 73. All right, a good omen, proof that Marconi was one of us, and that he had the knack. All right, let's see. A couple things I wanted to mention. Let's see, the book promotion. We've got the book in the book promotion business. This is the commercial portion of the program. Yep, the book is still selling fine on Lulu. It's there. I'm not sure what Lulu's always running these contests, these promotions. The April promotion is, of course, over, but I'm sure it'll be followed by the May promotion. So if you're thinking about buying the book, keep an eye on the blog, because I'll let you know what special coupon code you have to use to save 10 or 15% or whatever it is. I also recently I'm making available on Lulu the other book. We refer to it as the other book because it doesn't have anything to do with radio. It's a book that I wrote a long time ago and got published in 2006. It was commercially published by Naval Institute Press. It has to do with foreign affairs, and some of you guys might be interested in it. It's called Contra Cross, and I have a link to it on the blog page. You just scroll down on the right. Warning, it's not about radio, so we won't talk about it here anymore, but that's the other book, and I've got it. It's being sold on Lulu, and that one you can buy as a download, or you can buy it in paperback form. So if you're interested in, like I said, if you're interested in Solder Smoke the book, just keep an eye out for the next promotional offer from the folks at Lulu. All right, now on to actual solder melting. And there's been a lot of that going on. Oh, wait a second. Hold on. Travelog. I forgot the most important element of Travelog this week. And I guess it's good that I forgot this because it shows you that I'm getting over it. All right, here's the deal. I don't want to turn this into a medical podcast, which could easily happen given that I am a radio amateur from the International Geophysical Year. And I know many listeners are of similar vintage, but anyway, it all happened last Sunday, a week ago Sunday. We were out there at the country place, and we were flying kites. And it's a long story, and it involves an approaching thunderstorm, and me being a little bit hyper about the kids' safety, and getting them away from the kites, and running around, and... anyway, as I was running after a kite at one point, my International Geophysical Year foot and ankle went into some sort of gopher hole out there in the field in the Sabine Hills, and my foot moved in a direction not intended by the designer. Okay. There's a few kind of knack related interesting elements here. First of all, and brace yourself, guys, here, I actually heard it. It was really loud. I heard it pop. Didn't hurt a lot, but I heard it pop, and I knew that something bad. I knew that an important cable had broke. It did. It was my Achilles tendon. So that was last Sunday, and what they do with these things is they have to do a bit of minor surgery to sew the broken cable back together, and they did that on Wednesday in a little hospital run by some of the nicest people you'd ever meet, a charming group of Italian nuns. And I tell you, if you have to have something like this done, you want to be in the care of folks like this. Anyway, they were really nice. And, you know, I took a strange sort of, and I guess this is a sign of the knack, kind of technical interest in it. Of course, it's not a lot of fun. It's kind of distressing when this happens to you. And it's no fun to go in and have them work on you like this. But I told my wife, I said, you know, I take, in a certain sense, it was a kind of a very satisfying thing. Because I think it does have to do with the knack. Because if you have the knack, you're, as Dilbert was, you're really bothered by things that don't work. Remember, Dilbert in the cartoon that gave us the knack, it all started in the doctor's office, and what he noticed was that the EKG machine or the EEG machine was broken. And as his mother talked to the doctor, he went down and fixed it. Well, as I sat there in the hospital, waiting to be wheeled into the operating room there, I thought of this as a repair project. And I was thinking, well, that's pretty cool. This thing's broken, and he's going to fix it. I also found myself checking out the test gear. Listen, all signs of the knack. Anyway, enough of that. It's slowing me down quite a bit, but the side benefit is it seems to be resulting in a whole lot more time in the shack. I can't go out and do anything. I'm really immobile. But listen, if you've got the knack, and you guys know what I'm talking about, some people think, I mean, a lot of people come up to me and they say, oh, man, wow, housebound for, you know, I got to have this cast on for 3 weeks. Housebound for 3 weeks. How awful. And I'm thinking, worse things have happened. So every dark cloud has a silver lining. But I'm fine. And the cast is on. The work is done. Now we got to just let it heal. And I'll be limping around for a while. But, it's a really minor thing and no big deal. All right, that's the kind of the medical portion of this week's Italian travel log. Enough of that. Now, as I said, there's been actually a lot of solder melting going on here. And since we last spoke, I've built both a receiver and a transmitter. And I feel good about this because sometimes I felt like I was drifting away from actual from the actual solder smoke and the actual solder melting. But no, I'm proud to report that there's been progress in both areas. First, on the receiver, this is inspired by the whisper transceiver of Gene W3PM. We've talked about this on the program before, and a number of guys around the world have been inspired by Gene's very simple and clean design for a transceiver for the whisper system. Parts came in, donated by Jim AL7RV, Michael AA1TJ, and a number of others, and it's one of these things that was just sitting there on the bench, just begging to be assembled. So, and I decided I wanted to do it. It all started with a little Colpitz oscillator. Gene's design makes use of a single stage Colpitz that drives the mixer, and so I built that oscillator and found it to be quite stable, even though it doesn't have any buffer stage or anything like that. It just goes right from the oscillator right into the mixer, and so I built the oscillator on the center of this big piece of copper clad board, and I have pictures of this up on the blog if you guys want to check it out. And there it sat. And then I said, okay, well, what do I need next? All right, well, I'm working on the receive side here, guys. So I left the whole right-hand side of the board empty for transmit circuits, and I figured I'd put the whole receiver side on the left-hand side of the board. The one common stage will be the Colpitz oscillator, and that's right in the center, appropriately the heart of the transceiver. All right, so then off to the left of the Colpitz oscillator, I pulled out a little SBL3 mixer. Now, for those of you who don't know, the SBL3 mixer and all these, the SBL series of mixers, it's a diode ring mixer in a can, in a little can. I guess it's about the size of your fingernail, maybe your thumbnail. Neat little silver can. I like the looks of them. And this is a diode ring mixer. It has the four diodes. I think there are little Schottky diodes in there. And it's got the two toroidal coils at either end. 50 ohms in, 50 ohms out. And a real neat little mixer package. Now, I like the SBL3 mixers. You know, I'm kind of averse to integrated circuits. For me, and I'm not the only one who feels this way, the ICs can be sort of like kind of black boxes, sort of miniature appliances. Now, I've used them. There are times to use them, of course, and I don't want to talk bad about anybody who uses them. It's just a matter of personal preference. You know, I was recently reading reading Chapter 8 of Experimental Methods in RF Design. Chapter 8 deals with direct conversion receivers, and I think it was Rick who wrote this chapter, if I'm not mistaken, but he makes a similar comment in there about the beloved NE602 chips that we've all used, you know. But and he points out that there's, you know, these I'm paraphrasing them here, but that they're a lot of the kind of the electronic, the detail of how those chips operate and what goes on in the circuitry is sort of locked in that little black box. Anyway, I'm not crazy about ICs, but I don't think we can even consider the SBL3 is not in that category, because you could crack it open, and I have at some point on the blog a picture that taken by somebody who actually did this. You just cut it open and you can physically see in there the four diodes and the two toroidal inductors. Not only that, I mean, we've all made our own equivalent circuits, and I've made diode ring mixers, So anyway, I like the SBL3. It's a nice, easy, simple way to use to come up with the mixer circuit. Took a piece, took some crazy glue, took that SBL3 and glued it down on the board there. So now I got the SBL3 mixer and the oscillator, and I'm thinking, wow, this is like almost a receiver. Let me test it out. Let me make sure everything's going okay. So at the RF input, I just put a little clip lead, little miniature antenna there, and at the IF output, the IF output should be at audio, I put my oscilloscope set up for audio, and then I turn on the signal generator on the bench, my old faithful Heathkit SG8 signal generator, tune it around 10 megahertz, and turn on the Colpitts oscillator. So all that's happening now is I've got a Colpitts oscillator going in to the LO port, the local oscillator port of the SBL3 diode ring mixer. And I figure as I tune around with that signal generator, I should all of a sudden see something jump up on that oscilloscope at audio range. And sure enough, right on the mark, right where it should be, there's the audio coming through. So without even having built the audio amplifiers, and with nothing in front of the SBL three other than the little piece of Radio Shack test lead, I knew that those stages of my evolving receiver were working. Now it came time to build an audio amplifier. At this point, almost all the circuits that you see for all kinds of ham radio receivers include those little triangles for the ICs. They're almost always some sort of op amp in there, an LM386. At this point, most guys go with the chips. And again, to each his own, that's fine. And I've been there and done that. But I wanted on this one to keep it discrete component, which, and there's a kind of logic here because I'm going to use this transceiver with my computer. And so I thought it would be nice to have everything outside the computer simple and discrete component, because once that audio goes in through the sound card, it's completely in IC land, in very large integration, CPU chips and all that. But I figured let's keep it simple on the outside. So I searched around and searched around, and looking for an appropriate audio amplifier, and I found it in a circuit from our friend Roger Hayward, in his article in QST called "The Ugly Weekender." This was a junk box receiver for 40 meters that appeared in QST a while back, and it was just perfect, just what I was looking for. Simple, clean design with the right input impedance. Looks like it had about the right amount of gain. Everything was perfect. So I built that thing on the lower left hand of the board. You could see it on the pictures on the blog. And now I had okay. Now I had I had the audio amplifier. Didn't squeal once. Not a single squeal out of this. I've never built an audio amplifier before that didn't require some taming. But Rogers worked perfectly the very first time. I really like this design. I think I may end up building many of these audio amplifiers. Every time I need an audio amplifier, I'm going to use Rogers design from the Ugly Weekender. I really like it. Anyway, I hooked that thing up to, obviously, to the IF or audio out from the SBL3, and then I said, I probably don't need anything in the front end. I don't need any RF amplifiers. Gene W3PM's design for the Whisper transceiver has an unusual, very narrow bandpass filter ahead of the SBL mixer in his in his transceiver, and you know, because this is a receiver designed for one very specific fixed frequency, and that is the frequency, the 200 hertz or so that we use for whisper operations. Gene was able to use one of the 10.140 crystals and actually put it in the bandpass filter. And the effect would be to have a very, very narrow a crystal filter, not in the IF, but at RF, and not in the IF stages, but in the actual front end of the receiver. And of course, there's a lot of benefits to doing this, but I wanted to keep it real simple, and so I've left space on the board, if in case I eventually want to put that kind of filter or perhaps another bandpass filter in there. But for now, all I did was I ran just a little piece of hookup wire from the antenna jack across the board into the RF pin of the SBL3 mixer, and that's it. Okay, now then it became time to fire this thing up. And I guess the first thing I used it with was a program, a really nice program, called FL Digi. And Jorge Arturo, down in Georgia, was the one who alerted me to FL Digi. FL Digi, it's a great program. I have it on my Ubuntu Linux computer. But I think it's also available for Windows and perhaps even for Mac. I'm not sure, but it's a great program. FL Digi stands for Fast Light Digital, and it is. It's fast and light, and it works great, and it receives the whole menagerie of digital signals. I'm not really good at recognizing them, but I can spot a PSK31 signal. I can spot an RTTY signal, things like that. So I fired this thing up, I hooked up the receiver, and it was real simple. My board sits right next to the little laptop computer, and it's audio out from the receiver to mic in on the sound card. Hook up the antenna to the antenna jack, and all of a sudden across the bottom of the screen this waterfall display comes up. And I can see PSK31 signals there right on it. So I just take my mouse, I click on one of the PSK31 signals, and just like a charm, absolutely perfectly clear text of conversations on PSK31 starts scrolling across the screen. It was a real kind of success moment with the new receiver. Great fun, big success. Really very, very gratifying. Then I fired it up. This whole thing is designed to work with Whisper, and so then I switched over and went and fired up the Whisper software, and it worked very well. It worked fairly well there. Let me tell you what happened there. It immediately started decoding incoming Whisper signals, and the software in the computer immediately started sending reports of my reception to the WhisperNet server. So I was reporting worldwide on the signals being received at my station, and that's one of the real beauties of the Whisper system. So right away my reception reports were being shared with radio amateurs around the world, and everybody could see who I was receiving here in Rome. And one thing that happens, though, and it's by no means the fault of the Whisper program or anything like that. It's just the fact that I'm using kind of a very old computer that's not really designed for the intense number crunching that goes into Whisper. I find that if I leave the whisper in receive mode for any length of time, for an hour or two, it'll eventually crash the computer. It'll crash the system. I can leave Whisper running all day and transmit, because there's nothing very intense going there on there. It's just churning out tones all day. On receive, on the other hand, that's a different story. There, the computer is making pretty intense use of the CPU, and it's some pretty intense number crunching and digital signal processing going on there. So I'm sure Whisper would work perfectly on computers that are a little bit more up to date. Even on my very problematic desktop here with the Linux system on it, I might try to run it there. But great success on the receive side, guys. It's sitting here on the board, and you could take a look at the pictures and see more information on the Blogspot page. So a lot of fun with that. All right, before I go on to talk about the transmitter, I just wanted to mention something else about receivers. You know, I love building receivers, and I think it's a shame that more radio amateurs don't do this. And you know, I know you guys have been around for a while, will know what I mean when I talk about this. There's been a long kind of deeply held belief in ham radio that building a quality receiver is somehow beyond the capability of a radio amateur. Going way back to the earliest days, it was considered acceptable or okay for a ham to try to build his transmitter. As a matter of fact, in the early days, there was no other way to do it, and almost all hams built their simple transmitters. But a receiver was considered, a good receiver was considered kind of beyond the capability of a ham. And I found this when I was in the Dominican Republic. I would talk to some of the old timers in the radio club down there at HI8RCD, and they would tell me, "Oh yeah, you know, no, we all built our transmitters, but we had to buy the receivers commercially because, you know, they're just too hard." And it shows up time and again in the ham radio literature. I was recently looking at one of the early compilations of technical topics. Michael AA1TJ very kindly sent me one of Pat Hawker's first compilations from the from his magnificent Tech Topics column in Radcom from the British Radio Society. And in there, at one point, Pat is talking about this, about the reluctance on the part of many radio amateurs to build receivers. But guys, if I can do it, anybody can do it. So get out there and build some receivers. They're a lot of fun, especially the real simple kind, especially this little direct conversion receiver. Great fun, very effective, and if you pick the right circuits, you could do it very easily. I really recommend Roger's ugly receiver circuit. Now on to the transmitter. I also built a transmitter. I think you guys are going to like this project, because the first version of this thing really seemed to be a crowd pleaser. I got a lot of email about this. Now, I guess a year, maybe two ago, a year or two ago, when I was first getting into this QRSS business, one of my problems was I needed a frequency standard. This was before I repaired my frequency counter. You guys remember when I repaired my frequency counter? Who can forget this repair project? This was when Tony Fishpool sent me the chip that had gone bad, the replacement chip. He sent me the replacement chip for the logic gates in this old frequency counter that I picked up at the Kempton Park Rally in London a long time ago. And then I took this chip and very, very painstakingly soldered it to the board upside down. You know, we discovered that they don't work very well that way. And so then I went through the excruciating process of getting it out of the board, destroying much of the board in the process, and then trying to get it back in there. Pins were broken. Curses were uttered. And I'm proud to say that I admitted all of this to my fellow radio amateurs You know, it wasn't an easy thing to admit when you do something like this, but I did it. Anyway, before that, the counter is working quite nicely, by the way. It's sitting there looking at the numbers right now. It's showing that my QRSS transmitter is transmitting at 10,140,062 hertz. Very good. Before I had the counter, I needed a frequency standard because I couldn't figure out exactly where I was. So I made this little oscillator board, and then I needed something to insulate it. And we had an old paperback copy of Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. We had a couple of them here. Dan's not my favorite author, but we had a couple of copies of these books, and I figured I needed to do something useful with it. And paper, you know, it's a good insulator. It's about the right size. The little board's just 3 inches by 3 inches. So I took the book, opened it up, made a square 3x3 cut inside the book, and basically turned the Da Vinci Code book into an insulator for my 30-meter frequency standard oscillator. Got it all set up, and so there it sat. And anytime I needed to get on frequency, I'd fire this thing up. I'd kind of zero-beat whatever rig I was working on with it, and off I'd go. Well, okay, so this thing sat there for a long time. People like this. I put pictures up out on the blog. You can see it there. But it's not doing anything now because I got the frequency counter. So lately I've been thinking about QRSS circuits and real simple QRSS circuits because I'd like to take a little transmitter back out to the country place if we ever go back. But it would be nice to have a little really portable QRSS rig that I could take out there and hook up to the my dipole antenna and see what we could do with a real antenna. Okay, so I start thinking around, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? We need some sort of form of modulation. And then the inspiration comes to me. As is often the case, it comes to me via that magnificent publication of the GQRP Club, SPRAT, devoted entirely to low-power communication, issue number 134, spring 2008. And as often is the case, the article is by that really phenomenal home brewer, inventive guy, Hans Summers, G0UPL. Hans had an article there, a 40-meter QRSS QRPP beacon with homebrew batteries. This was an article that Hans had done on building a simple rig and then making homebrew batteries using bleach, baked bean cans, 250-milliliter Johnson's orange juice bottles. And he made his own batteries, made his own power, and then made a little really low-power transmitter that could be run off of this homebrew power. And I really like this circuit that Hans came up with. For me, it's one of the really, it's just beautiful in its simplicity. I've got the schematic up on the blog. You can take a look at it there. Just scroll down a bit. Sometime in the last few weeks, I have it up there. Or you can just search under QRSS or search under Hans Summers on the left-hand side of the blog page. You'll find it. But it's just a one transistor Colpitz oscillator, and then for the modulation, he's got an A-stable multivibrator running at four cycles per minute, very slow. So four cycles per minute, every 15 seconds, this bistable A-stable multivibrator changes states. It's just two little transistors switching on and switching off. And he uses that A-stable multivibrator switching on and switching off to vary the frequency of the one-stage crystal control Colpitz oscillator, to vary the frequency by, you know, 5 hertz. The result of this is that when this little the signal from the crystal oscillator appears on the screen of the QRSS receiver, there's a pattern, and you can see the pattern. Without the the modulation from the A-stable multivibrator, you'd just see a little line and you couldn't tell that it was, you know, the product of human ingenuity. But that little pattern, that distinct pattern there, marks it as a signal with, you know, with intent, with a human hand behind it. Anyway, this also gets back to the no IC kind of mentality here. Now, as I was working with this A-stable multivibrator, I had a bit of trouble, and a number of guys wrote in and said, "Yeah, why don't you just use a 555 timer chip?" And again, I could have. I've been there. I've used them. But there was something really attractive about making my own little version of the 555 timer using two little transistors, a few resistors, a couple of capacitors. Anyway, I got it all sorted out, and it was just great. I mean, I made a real silly mistake here, and I couldn't get the A-stable multivibrator to work when I realized that I instead of using 680K resistors, I had used 68K resistors, and I guess those little resistors are getting a little too small for my IGY eyes. Anyway, after some coaching from a number of guys on the QRPL list and the Knights of QRSS list, I got it squared away, and the A-stable multivibrator is multivibrating quite nicely. Anyway, the whole thing is working, and it sits there, and I use the grabber, the receive station of Johan ON5EX up in Belgium, and this little one-stage transmitter with two transistors for modulation churns out less than 10 milliwatts. I know it's less than 10 milliwatts, and it's most days it's very solid into Johan's machine up in Belgium pretty much all day long. If the sun is up over Europe, my little signal is making it into Johan's machine. So really great stuff, great fun. We've I had an interesting experience that when I first put it up and it first started running, when I looked at Johan's screen, there was another signal there, and I was pretty much right on top of him, you know. So, and I looked and I found I was surprised to find that the other signal was Alan, a VK2ZAY, all the way from Australia, and he was running 150 milliwatts and making the trip all the way from down under into Johan's machine. So I joked later on that I'd run into my old friend Alan in Belgium. So I did a quick QSY. I shifted down in frequency by 20 hertz. I dropped by 20 hertz, and so that put Alan's very, very nice, very sophisticated signal that includes Hellscriber and FSK along the middle of the screen, and my little very simplistic kind of waveform signal down below. So great fun with that. When I built Hans's circuit, I did something a little bit different. He uses a 5 millimeter red LED to produce the frequency shift. You know, what happens is the multivibrator goes on and off, and it puts, you know, varying voltage at the output port, and Hans uses this changing voltage with an LED, and he uses the LED in reverse bias, so it's reverse bias, and he's using it as, in effect, a varactor diode, because as the voltage across this little LED changes, the capacitance of the LED changes, and that changes a bit of the capacitance in the transistor, And that gives you the frequency shift, and that results in the pattern on the screens. But I put my diode in the other way. I put my diode in downward pointing, forward biased, because I was thinking of it as a switch, because in other rigs I've used a diode as a little switch, and what happened in other rigs was the modulation signal would come in, and the diode would serve as a switch and would switch in an additional 5 picofarads of capacitance, and that would change the frequency. Now, we've had some really interesting discussions on the nights of the QRSS mailing list about what's really going on with my little forward-biased diode. Is it working as a switch, or is it working as a varactor but forward biased? I think the jury is still out. I think it might be a little bit of both, but we'll have to do some additional tests to figure out what's really going on there. But I will tell you that in my circuit, the super bright blue LEDs that Jim AL7RV sent me, they light up. So on key down, my little LED actually lights up, not super bright, very faintly, because it's being fed through a 1 meg resistor, but it does light up, which indicates to me that the diode is turning on. Maybe not full on, it might be in that curve portion of the VI curve on the diode, so that it may be a combination of the diode is turning on, it's connecting a bit of the 5 picofarad capacitance into the system, and it's adding a bit of additional capacitance because it's being forward biased a little bit more. In any event, whether it's a diode or a varactor or a little bit of both, it's changing the capacitance in that oscillator, and it's generating the pattern. I've done some experimenting using red diodes and blue diodes, red and blue LEDs, and just switching diodes. A lot of fun, really interesting stuff. So we'll continue to work with that. So those were the two big projects here in the last month, a receiver and a transmitter. And I may have to get this transmitter, I may have to add a buffer stage and maybe a little oscillator stage and a buffer stage, because I find that I did take it out to the country, and it works fine if it's sitting here on the bench. But if I take it out to the country, because there's no buffer stages between the oscillator and the antenna, even if I have it perfectly aligned for the QRSS frequency while I'm here in Rome, when I take it out to the country and hook it up to a different antenna system, the change in load completely changes the frequency of the oscillator, and I don't feel like dragging my frequency counter out there with me. So I think the solution might be just to build a proper buffer stage to isolate the oscillator from the antenna load and prevent this kind of pulling. This is inevitably going to happen if you just have the oscillator going right into the antenna. So we'll see what happens there. I just don't feel like dragging the frequency counter out to the woods and making the adjustments out there. Although it is kind of nice having a transmitter when you know the whole thing is just one transistor. Again, it's quite a contrast with what's going on inside the computer. All right, that's the solder that's been melted here. A couple other kind of news items here. The guys out there at the Dover Construction Club that I visited back in February mentioned something to me that I don't think I passed on. They have discovered a phenomenon that is fairly common in their club workshop. It has to do with black holes swallowing up parts, and they've noticed that the black holes seem to be generated as soon as an important part is dropped from the workbench. As the part falls to the ground, the black hole appears. The part disappears into the multiverse, never to be seen again. And, you know, guys, I've been giving this some thought, and you're not too far from CERN. You're not too far from the the big new research facility, well, the big research facility up there on the French-Swiss border. And, you know, they're running the Large Hadron, or Hadron Collider, the LHC. And I'm wondering, you think this could be? You know, there's been concern about the black holes that this thing might generate, and concern that it might be, that they might just swallow up the whole planet. Could it be that they're not quite that big, but they're big enough to swallow up your little SMT parts? We'll have to give this some thought. I think that this requires some additional investigation. Hey, another news item. Altoids. Somebody sent a message to me saying, where are Altoids made? And I had always assumed that Altoids were a product of the United Kingdom. I mean, I've always thought of this as a very, very British thing. And I was shocked to find out that they are now manufactured in Tennessee. Guys, it just doesn't seem right. Altoids. I always like what they have in a very British way, very understated, you know, very kind of don't brag. They're billed as a curiously refreshing mint. Our British cousins don't like to brag. They don't like to overstate things. So this is very typical of British advertising. British advertising will often have the person who's selling the product say something like, "It's really not too bad." So Altoids, a curiously refreshing mint, but manufactured now in Tennessee. Holy cow, it just doesn't seem right. Nothing against Tennessee, but I think you guys know what I mean. I was reading that a little bit on the history of the Altoids, and Joff, KD8EEG, sent me some information on this. They were introduced in 1780 back in Britain, and but now made in Tennessee. I don't know about that. I was reading Tim Walford's construction club out there in the west of England. Put out another fine issue of Hot Iron, and Tim very kindly sent it to me, and he talked about a battery problem that affects laptops, older laptops, and that is that the battery in the laptop is perfectly good, but for some reason the computer sees it as being drained, and you can try to charge it up, and it charges up a little bit, and it looks like it's fully charged. It may actually be fully charged, but then when you plug it into the computer, after about 2 minutes, the computer starts complaining that the battery is low. So I don't know. He mentioned this in the Hot Iron, and it seemed like there might be a solution out there, but I'm not quite sure what it is. If anybody knows how to do this, how to fix this, or how to change this, let me know, because I got this problem with my Tekra 8100, and we got a lot of traveling coming up this summer. I'd like to take it with me, and it'd be a great help if I could get the battery working. You know, I mentioned the Large Hadron Collider. You know, N3ZI is the guy who makes these little cheap $10 counters that Jerry, NR5A, very kindly sent me one of these a while back, a couple years ago now, I think, and I put one together, had great fun with it, and I was recently having email exchanges with the guy who puts these kits together, N3ZI. And I noticed on his website he was really pleased that some of his kits were actually used in work associated with the Large Hadron Collider. Check it out. If you just do a search on his site, N3ZI, it'll take you to the website, and you can see where he mentions the use of his counter kits in the LHC. So fine business, and congratulations to N3ZI. I put up recently a video that I really liked, and it was a talk that George Dobbs of the GQRP Club, G3RJV, gave at a ham radio club in England. And it was really, I really enjoyed it. It was great fun. It went on for about an hour, and I put the links and everything up. It's up on the blog, and it really is the kind of George giving sort of the essence of the QRP part of this hobby. And George always does it, you know, I'm sure because of his profession as a minister. He has a real great way of capturing the kind of the spiritual, philosophical roots of the hobby and then combining that with really high quality technical presentation. So if you're looking for some inspiration, if you're looking for kind of a nice history of some of the rigs that we use and where they come from and their origins and a lot of information about the Sudden Receiver, just follow the link on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, and you're in for a treat. Just get yourself a cup of coffee, have some piece of gear to work on while you're listening, and off you go. All right. That brings us to
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love them.
Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. Paul, M0, some of this stuff is a bit dated because it's been a month since I've churned out a Solder Smoke, so forgive me for being a little bit behind on this. Paul, M0XPD, sent me some information about a funky keyer circuit, and I put this up on the blog. He likes the keyer circuits, but he doesn't like the kind of automated, dehumanized kind of rhythm that they produce. So Paul's funky keyer, and this is based on funky music, includes sort of some randomness in there that makes it sound more human. So an interesting concept. Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. And I have that up on the blog. Tom, NC0O, needs a source for Altoids tins. If anybody has any extra Altoids tins, Tom is looking for them. Well, I guess they're available in Tennessee now, Tom. Our old friend Jeff, KO7M, who we had here on the show a while back, still flying around in that beautiful Piper Cub, and used that airplane to literally drop in on another Solder Smoke fan, Eldon, WA0UWH. Eldon is recently involved in QRSS and all kinds of interesting projects, and his website describes the visit by air of Jeff, KO7M. So just do a web search on Eldon's call, and you could see some great pictures and a description of their really great visit. Greg, OH2FFY, our friend in Finland, an Australian in Finland. It's going to be getting cold up there, Greg. He's also working on W3PM's Whisper rig, so thanks for sharing that with us. Good luck with that rig, and good luck with the well, summer's coming, so you're okay, but it just, the contrast, Australia and Finland, two very different countries. It must be interesting. Robert, XE1 GXG, also known as WB7AVF, he too is working on, down there in Guadalajara, is also working on a W3PM Whisper rig. You see, Gene, your rig has become famous worldwide. It's being worked on in Finland, Mexico, Rome, Italy, and probably a number of points in the United States. Congratulations. He could use some toroids and a crystal. I think I'm going to be able to help him out with the toroids because somebody very kindly put toroids in an envelope and sent me two packages of T50-2 toroids, and I don't know who sent it to me. Whoever it is, please shoot me an email, and thanks very much. But it came at a really, you know, very propitious moment because it came right around the time that Roberto was asking for toroids. So I'm going to try to get them to him in Mexico, and we'll see if that can help with the Guadalajara version of the W3PM Whisper transceiver. Andrew VK5CV writes in And I have to do a little joke here. He has a CV that reads like a diagnosis of the knack. Boom, boom. Yeah, Andrew, you've got it bad, old man. There's nothing you can do about it. Just melt a lot of solder and you'll feel better. Peter VE3GYY is getting going on home brewing, and he couldn't have started in a better way. He's using W1FB designs and looking at those bare bones receivers, those bare bones SSB receivers that Doug DeMore designed and wrote about. I built one. I think it's a great way to go. And I have mine sitting here, the Barbados receiver, real bare bones stuff, very simple, just nothing fancy, nothing extra, but a very effective single conversion super head, great stuff. Bert PA1B wrote in, and he told me that he has read Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur three times, and he in his time as a radio amateur, he's gone completely through the book three times. You know, studying it and absorbing the information at different levels. And he's built two rigs directly from circuits in that book. And I put him in touch with Wes W7ZOI because I knew that Wes would like to hear how carefully that book has been read in certainly in Bert's ham shack and in places around the world. Mike ZS6MEG wrote, and this was sort of an answer to my request for help in getting solder smoke on the shortwave bands. He's running some sort of voice beacon system there in South Africa on HF, and he needs audio to fill up the time on the voice beacon. And I said, well, go for it. Yeah, put solder smoke on. So apparently, several times a week, this program is being transmitted on HF frequencies in the Republic of South Africa. So a big shout out to South Africa, and thanks to Mike ZS6MEG for putting us on the air. Bill K2YO and others pointed out that in my description of our astronomical adventures at the Ponticelli Scandria Amateur Astronomical Observatory that I got the North America Nebula wrong. I was pointing my telescope at the nebula in the Sword of Orion, and it sort of looked like North America to me. I don't know. And I remember that there's this nebula called the North America Nebula, so named because it looks like North America. And so I was standing there with our Canadian friends, and it just seemed perfect. And I turned to them and said, look into the scope, and you will see the North America Nebula, named for the homeland of both of our families. And they kind of saw it. They said, yeah, yeah, kind of see the Gulf of Mexico down there. Wrong constellation, guys. Completely wrong part of the sky. But, hey, it looked a bit like North America to me. I haven't told our friends yet. I think I might keep this one quiet. Bob writes in, and he found an article that points out that the human ear makes use of a mechanism that includes feedback and what we would call in the radio world regeneration. And I had never heard about this. And I've got to take a closer look at the links, but he points out that maybe this explains our interest in regens, because in a certain sense, we are regens, or we have regen receivers in our heads. I don't know. You guys know how I feel about regens. I guess this makes me think about them again, but I don't know. I still think that there's something not quite holy about those kinds of receivers. We'll see. Anyway, Lee, a G0IAY, wrote in, and he said he made it back to the UK from his latest trip to Beijing. He got back just before the Icelandic volcanic cloud hit. I'm glad to hear that, Lee. I did think about you when the travel ban kicked in. And he's going to be working on whisper beacons also. He wants to get into the whisper beacon thing. Glad to hear you You made it back. Finally, Neil, K7AQK, writes to ask whether the knack is hereditary, because he thinks that his grandfather had it, but it may have skipped a generation with his dad. I'd say in some cases it is, some cases it isn't, but I think the important thing is not to push it on anybody. You know, I think that's the best way to handle it. It could be there. Sometimes it shows up later in life, but I'd say not necessarily hereditary. Sometimes it just can't be explained. I don't think there's anybody before me that showed any symptoms of it at all. So there you go. I don't know. We'll have to leave that to medical science to determine. Hey, I've been rambling on quite some time here, guys. I think we might be pressing up against the limit. Thanks very much. Sorry for the delay. And I hope the spring is going well for everybody in the Northern Hemisphere. I hope everybody has good luck with all their projects, and I hope to have another solder smoke out without so much of a delay next time. Thanks for listening. 7-3 from Rome.
Ciao, bravi ragazzi.